Looking through these chapter excerpts you shared on economic growth, it really hits you how something that sounds simple, like the economy getting bigger, is actually, well, really layered. So our goal today for everyone listening is to kind of peel back those layers, get under the hood, without drowning in jargon. We want to figure out what growth really means, how we even measure it, and spoiler alert, those measurements can be pretty tricky.
Yeah, definitely imperfect.
Exactly. And why it's always being discussed, plus some of the, well, surprising trade-offs involved.
Absolutely. It touches, I mean, pretty much every part of our lives, right? Jobs, prices, everything. And while, yeah, the goal is usually growth, understanding the how and the why and the challenges gives you a much better perspective.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. How does money actually move around? The sources mention this circular flow of income. Sounds a bit academic, maybe.
It can sound that way, but the basic idea is actually pretty neat. Think of a really simple economy. You've just got households, that's us and firms, businesses. Households, we supply the firms with what economists call factors of production.
Factors of production, like what?
So think about making, I don't know, a chair. You need the workshop. That's like land. You need people doing the work. That's labor. You need the saws and tools. That's capital. And then you need the person who had the idea and organized it all. That's the enterprise bit.
So we as households offer our work, our labor, and we get paid wages for it.
Exactly. And the person who owns the workshop space gets rent. The people who lent money for the tools get interest. And the entrepreneur, the one taking the risk, hopefully gets profit. All that income flows to the households.
Okay, and then what do we do with that income? We don't just stash it under the mattress, usually.
Right. We spend it. We buy the chairs, the food, the services that the firms produce. And that spending money goes back to the firms as revenue.
And then the firms use that revenue to pay for the labor, the rent, the interest, the profits, all over again.
You got it. It's this continuous loop. Money flowing one way, goods and services and resources flowing the other, like a heartbeat, as you said.
It is. Now, the sources start with a simple model, just households and firms, but then they mention a four-sector model. What else gets added in?
Yeah, the two-sector model is just to get the core concept. The four-sector one is, well, more realistic for modern economies. It brings in the government.
Right, taxes and public spending.
Exactly. And financial institutions, banks, basically channeling savings into investment. And crucially, the foreign sector.
Imports and exports.
That makes it an open economy, trading with other countries instead of a closed one. But that fundamental circular flow, it's still the engine underneath it all, just, with more connections.
Okay, that makes sense. So we have this cycle: production, income, spending, round and round. How on earth do we measure how big this whole thing is? It's GDP, right? Gross domestic product.
That's the one, GDP. It's the headline number you always hear. And the definition is really key here. It's the total market value.
Market value, so prices.
Yes, the total market value of all final goods and services produced within a country's borders in a given period, usually a year.
Okay, final and within a country's borders. Why are those bits so important?
Final means we don't double count. Take that chair again. We count the price of the finished chair, not the value of the wood and the value of the finished chair. That would inflate the number.
Got it. Avoids counting the inputs multiple times and within a country's borders.
That means it doesn't matter who owns the company. If a factory located here makes something, even if the company's headquarters are overseas, it counts towards our GDP. It's about where the production happens.
Okay, clear. So adding up the price tags of all the final stuff made here. But the sources said there are like three different ways to calculate this. How does that work?
Yeah, three main approaches to try and arrive at that same number. The first one is often called the expenditure approach.
Expenditure.
Ah.
So looking at who's spending the money.
Exactly. It adds up all the spending on those final goods and services. You see that formula, C plus I plus G plus XM. C is?
Consumption. That's us, households, buying groceries, cars, haircuts, you name it.
Right. I is investment.
Yep. Business spending on new factories, machines, equipment also includes new house construction, interestingly.
Okay. G.
Government spending, roads, schools, defense, salaries for public workers.
Makes sense. And X minus M.
Net exports. So exports, the stuff we sell abroad, minus imports, the stuff we buy from abroad, add all those up. C plus I plus G plus XM, and you get GDP from the spending side.
Okay, that seems logical. Adding up all the demand. What's the second way? Income approach.
Correct. The income approach looks at the other side of the coin. Instead of who's spending, it asks who's earning the income generated from producing all that stuff.
Ah, so adding up the wages, rent, interest, and profits we talked about earlier? Precisely. Wages for labor, rent for land, interest for capital, profits for enterprise. Sum all those incomes, and you should, in theory, get the same GDP figure. One important exclusion here, though, is transfer payments.
Like unemployment benefits or pensions.
Exactly. Those aren't payments for current production. They're just redistributing existing income. So they're not counted in the income approach to GDP.
Right. Got it. Okay. Expenditure income. What's the third one?
Output. The output or product approach. This one looks directly at the value added by each industry in the economy.
Value added.
Yeah. So it sums up the market value of all final goods and services produced, sector by sector, agriculture, manufacturing, services, etc. Again, the trick is meticulously avoiding double counting those intermediate goods, the inputs. Focus only on the value of the final output of each sector.
So three different angles, spending, earning, producing, all aiming for the same GDP number. That's complex.
It is. And they rarely match up perfectly in practice because of data issues, but they provide checks on each other.
Okay. Now, another really vital point the sources made was the difference between nominal and real GDP. This seems crucial for understanding growth.
Oh, absolutely critical. The difference is all about inflation, about changing prices.
Okay.
Nominal GDP is calculated using the prices that exist right now in the current year. So if prices go up, nominal GDP goes up, even if we haven't actually produced any more stuff.
Oh. So it can look like growth, but it might just be inflation pushing prices higher.
Exactly. It mixes up changes in actual output with changes in the price level. Real GDP tries to fix that.
How?
It adjusts for inflation. It takes the quantities produced in the current year, but values them using the prices from a specific base year in the past.
So you're comparing apples to apples, quantity-wise, over time, by using constant prices.
Precisely. It strips out the effect of rising prices to give you a much better sense of whether the actual volume of goods and services produced has increased or decreased. If you want to talk about real economic growth, you need to look at real GDP.
Right. Nominal might go up just because everything got more expensive, but real GDP tells you if we actually made more stuff.
You've got it. That's the key takeaway. Now, even with real GDP, measuring national income, as sources really hammer home, is far from straightforward. It's got problems.
Yeah, this part was fascinating. We see these GDP numbers all the time, treated like gospel, but there's so much they miss or struggle with, like non-monetary transactions. What falls under that?
Think about all the valuable work done within a household that doesn't involve money changing hands.
Yeah.
Cooking meals, cleaning, childcare. Hugely valuable, contributes massively to well-being, right?
Absolutely.
But it's generally not counted in GDP because there's no market transaction. Same if you grow your own vegetables in the garden and eat them.
Yes.
It's real production, real consumption, but no money changes hands. So typically left out.
Wow. So a huge amount of actual economic activity is just invisible in the official stats.
Yeah.
What about the underground economy? That sounds like it must mess things up too.
Oh, significantly. This includes illegal activities, obviously, like drug trafficking, which generates income but isn't reported. But it also includes legal activities that are hidden to avoid taxes or regulations. Think unreported cash payments for jobs, undeclared tips, that sort of thing.
So work that's done off the books.
Exactly. By its very nature, it's hidden, making it incredibly hard to measure accurately. So official GDP figures underestimate the true level of economic activity, sometimes by quite a lot, depending on the country.
That makes sense. And then there's petty production. Is that similar?
It's related, yeah. This refers more to very small-scale, often informal producers. Think street vendors, smallholder farmers selling a bit of surplus produce, someone doing repairs from their home. They often don't keep detailed financial records, maybe operate largely in cash.
So it's just hard to track their actual output and income accurately.
Very hard. Collecting reliable data from millions of tiny, informal operations is a massive challenge for statisticians.
And how do you even value things like, say, the police force or public schools? There's no market price for national security.
That's a classic problem. Since there's no direct market price, the standard approach is to value these public services at their cost of production.
So, like the salaries paid to police officers and teachers, the costs of buildings and equipment.
Exactly. But that's an imperfect proxy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily measure the actual value or quality of the service provided to society. A really inefficient police force might cost a lot, but deliver poor value.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. And we talked about inflation with nominal versus real GDP, but the sources mentioned price changes being a problem even beyond that.
Yes, because even real GDP, while adjusting for the overall price level, doesn't capture how price changes for specific goods affect different people. Imagine if the price of basic food and energy skyrockets, but the price of luxury cars falls. Real GDP might still go up overall, but people on lower incomes who spend a large chunk of their budget on those basics could be significantly worse off in terms of their actual purchasing power and living standards. The single number hides those distributional effects.
Right. The average can hide a lot of variation. What about wages paid in kind, like getting free accommodation with a job?
Yeah. Benefits like company cars, free meals, housing allowances, these are part of someone's compensation. They have real value. But estimating that monetary value accurately and consistently across different jobs and sectors can be difficult, leading to potential undercounting in national income figures.
And the sources even brought up illiteracy or just lack of understanding affecting the numbers. How so?
Well, think about surveys used to collect income data, especially in developing economies or areas with large informal sectors. If people can't accurately read, understand, or recall their earnings and expenses, or if they don't keep records, the data collected might be inaccurate or incomplete. This can lead to underestimation.
Okay. And there are a few others, like secondhand sales aren't counted, right? Because that's not new production.
Correct. Selling a used car doesn't add to this year's GDP, as its value is counted when it was first produced, including it would be double counting.
But the point about environmental damage.
Right.
That seems huge. GDP ignores it.
Largely, yes. Standard GDP accounting doesn't subtract the cost of pollution or the depletion of natural resources. So, a country could cut down all its forests, sell the timber, and GDP would go up.
Even though it's clearly damaging future well-being.
Exactly. It measures production, but not necessarily sustainable well-being. There are efforts to create green GDP measures, but they're complex and not widely adopted yet. Same goes for accurately estimating depreciation, the wearing out of machinery and buildings, and just general data gaps, especially in less developed countries.
Wow. Okay, so GDP is useful, definitely, but we have to be really aware of its limitations. It's not the whole story by any means.
Not at all. It's a valuable indicator, but just one piece of the puzzle.
So let's shift then. Keeping those measurement issues in mind, what actually makes an economy grow? What are the drivers?
Right. So economic growth, defined basically, is that sustained increase in real GDP over time. The factors behind it generally fall into two big buckets.
Okay. What are they?
Bucket one is getting more resources, an increase in the quantity of inputs available.
More inputs.
Like
more workers.
Yeah, exactly. More labor. Maybe the population grows and more people start working, or through immigration, more physical capital, investing in more machines, more factories, better roads, better infrastructure.
Yeah.
And potentially finding or accessing more natural resources, although that's often geographically limited, more inputs generally mean you can produce more output.
Makes intuitive sense. More hands, more tools, more materials.
Yeah.
More stuff gets made. What's the second bucket? You said improvements in quality.
Yes, and this is often seen as the key to long-term sustainable growth. It's about improving the quality or productivity of those inputs.
How does that work?
Well, think about labor. Better education, better training, better health care, that leads to what we call improved human capital.
A more skilled and healthier workforce.
Exactly. And more skilled workforce can produce more output even with the same number of people and tools. They're more productive. Then there's technology.
Technological advances.
Huge driver. New inventions, better production techniques, higher quality machinery. All these allow us to get more output from the same amount of inputs. Think about the impact of computers, the internet, automation, massive productivity gains.
So it's not just having more resources, it's about having better resources and using them more effectively.
Precisely. Quality and productivity improvements are really powerful engines for growth.
Okay. Now, we generally assume growth is good. The sources talked about benefits like higher living standards, more jobs.
Absolutely. Those are the big ones. Growth typically means more income, allowing people to afford more goods and services, leading to, on average, higher material living standards, more variety, too.
And more jobs, presumably, as businesses expand.
Generally, yes. Growing economies tend to create more employment opportunities. This boosts confidence. Businesses feel more optimistic, invest more. And governments benefit too.
How so?
More economic activity means more tax revenue, income taxes, sales taxes, corporate taxes. That gives the government more resources to spend on public services or reduce debt.
So higher living standards, more jobs, more investment, more government revenue. Sounds pretty good.
Mm.
But the sources also mention costs or downsides. It's not all positive.
No, there are definitely potential trade-offs and costs to consider. For one, focusing heavily on future growth might mean sacrificing some current consumption. Mm-hmm. If a country decides to invest heavily in building new factories or infrastructure capital goods, that means fewer resources might be available right now to produce consumer goods like clothes or electronics. A short-term trade-off.
Okay. What else?
Sometimes rapid growth can lead to increased stress, maybe longer working hours, more competition, impacting work-life balance and well-being for some.
Yeah, I can see that.
And the big one we touched on earlier, the environmental impact. More production often means more resource use, more pollution, more waste, unless the growth is managed in a very sustainable way.
Right, the environmental degradation issue again.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, if demand grows really fast, it can outstrip supply, leading to inflationary pressures, rising prices, or demands for higher wages that can also fuel inflation.
So growth isn't automatically benign. It can come with environmental costs, social costs, potential inflationary issues.
Exactly. It highlights the need to think not just about the rate of growth, but the quality and sustainability of that growth.
Which brings us neatly to economic sustainability. What's the core idea there?
It's fundamentally about ensuring that the way we pursue economic growth today doesn't mess things up for future generations, meeting our needs now without compromising their ability to meet their own needs later.
So balancing the present and the future, what does that look like in practice? What are the objectives?
The sources likely broke it down into sort of three pillars: economic objectives. Using resources efficiently, not wastefully. Investing smartly in things that boost long-term productivity, like education, human capital, and green infrastructure, physical capital.
Okay. And social objectives.
Promoting fairness and equity. Ensuring everyone has access to basic necessities like decent housing, good education, quality healthcare. Growth shouldn't leave large segments of society behind.
Makes sense. And the third pillar must be
environmental, using natural resources at a rate that allows them to replenish, minimizing pollution and waste, protecting biodiversity, tackling climate change, basically not destroying the planet that supports the economy in the first place.
So sustainable growth tries to tick all three boxes: economic, social, and environmental. A much more holistic view than just chasing the GDP number.
Definitely. It's about long-term well-being, not just short-term output.
Okay. Now, the last big topic covered was what happens when things go wrong, when the economy shrinks instead of grows. Recession. How is that actually defined?
The textbook definition, the one you hear most often, is a period when real GDP falls for two consecutive quarters. So 6 months or more of the economy actually contracting.
Two quarters of negative growth.
Okay.
And what typically causes a recession? What pushes an economy into reverse?
Broadly speaking, again, two main types of triggers, or shocks, as economists call them. Demand-side shocks.
Meaning something causes overall spending to drop suddenly?
Exactly. Could be a crash in consumer confidence, people get worried about the future, stop buying big ticket items, or businesses get pessimistic and slash investment spending.
Or maybe government cuts spending drastically.
That too. Or maybe a major trading partner goes into recession, so our exports collapse. Anything that causes a significant drop in CIG or net exports can trigger a demand-side recession.
Okay. And the other type? Supply-side shocks.
These are things that disrupt the economy's ability to produce goods and services. The classic example is a sudden spike in oil prices, making energy and transport much more expensive for almost everyone.
Right, that affects costs across the board.
Or think about natural disasters, earthquakes, floods that destroy infrastructure and disrupt production, or, well, a global pandemic shutting down factories and supply chains.
Yeah, we've seen that recently. So supply shocks make it harder or more expensive to produce stuff.
Exactly. They reduce the economy's potential output.
Okay, so recessions can start from either a lack of demand or a disruption to supply. What are the consequences? What happens during a recession?
They're usually pretty painful. The most obvious impact is rising unemployment. Businesses facing lower demand or higher costs often lay off workers.
which means people lose income.
Exactly. Lower incomes, falling living standards, potentially rising poverty rates. People cut back spending further, which can make the recession worse.
Vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. Businesses also tend to pull back on investment during recessions because the future looks uncertain. Less investment means less new capital, which can slow down future growth even after the recession ends.
What about the government? Government finances usually take a hit. Tax revenues fall because people are earning less and companies are making less profit. At the same time, government spending often increases on things like unemployment benefits. So deficits tend to widen.
Right. And prices. What happens to inflation during a recession?
It depends on the cause. In a typical demand-side recession, weak spending usually leads to lower inflation or sometimes even deflation, falling prices. But in a supply-side recession, like one caused by high oil prices.
Oh, you can get the worst of both worlds.
You can. That's stagflation. The economy stagnates or shrinks, unemployment is high, and prices are rising because production costs have gone up. It's a particularly nasty combination.
Definitely sounds like something to avoid. Wow, okay. This has covered a huge amount of ground. From the basic money flow.
Circular flow, yeah.
To how we try imperfectly to measure the whole economy with GDP.
Nominal versus real and all the measurement challenges.
To what makes economies grow more resources or better resources.
Quantity and quality, yeah.
The upsides and the downsides of that growth. Benefits and costs.
The crucial idea of making it sustainable.
Economic, social, environmental balance.
And finally, what happens when things go backwards in a recession. Causes and consequences. It really shows how interconnected it all is.
It really does. And having a grasp of these basics, it just helps make sense of so much economic news and policy debate, doesn't it? It helps you be a more informed citizen, really.
Absolutely. So for everyone listening, as you process all this, maybe really mull over those challenges in measuring GDP. It's a reminder that that single number, while important, gives just one kind of narrow perspective on national well-being.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe think about this. Considering all the benefits and the costs of growth we talked about, what do you think is the single biggest challenge we face in trying to achieve growth that is truly sustainable, that balances everything looking ahead?
That's a great question to chew on. Something to think about. Well, thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive today.
My pleasure.
We really hope walking through economic growth like this has given you all some useful clarity on a really vital topic.